Mornings are better with a warm beverage, even for Latter-day Saints. Meet Postum, the ideal coffee alternative and proud sponsor of This Week in Mormons podcast. Spot it on the coffee aisle at Smith's Grocery or at your local nearby store. Can't locate it? No worries. Order it at Postum.com. Explore delicious recipes to tailor your Postum experience. Start your day off right with Postum.
Welcome, everybody, to This Week in Mormons with Matt and Melissa. How are you doing, Melissa?
Hi, Matt. I am doing so good. How are you doing?
My internet's been a little bit glitchy today. I don't know about you.
No.
Your internet's been glitchy.
Listen, I don't let the internet world get me down. It's fine.
Well, today we have a special guest with us for an interview. It's Rob Newcomb. And would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Yeah. So, Robert Newcomb. I am running for U.S. Senate here in Utah to take or replace Mitt Romney
here in
2024. Yeah, there's quite a few candidates. I think there's a total of 16 of us.
Oh, really?
Which will be narrowed down quite a bit here
in the primaries
by September.
Okay.
Yeah, between the primaries and whoever else doesn't get the enough signatures to be on the ballot. So, so that's me. I'm married and I have five kids, we have twins that are, just turned 6 years old, and our oldest daughter is 13, going on 16, but
you're in the prime of your life right now. Just hold on tight.
Okay.
So are you a Utah lifer, born and raised in Utah?
I'm not. No, I was actually born in Oregon, went to high school in California. My wife was born in Oregon as well. We actually went to the same high school together. I knew who she was. She comes from a family of 11, right? Born and raised in the church. I was not born and raised in the church. We didn't officially meet until after I joined the church at 19. But I wasn't born in Utah, but I'm definitely a lifer here. Just based on, I graduated college here, and I've spent enough time here to know that I want to raise my kids here, multi-generational, effort. So for
okay,
sure.
So you and your wife went to the same high school at the same time?
No, she was a few years behind me.
Okay.
I wrestled with her brothers who were champions, everyone knew them because they were the only, Mormons in the school almost, but family of 11, it's hard to miss. And they were for sure, when I was in high school, they were for sure an example to me of, what Mormons are.
Yeah.
Right. In general. So.
Interesting. Yep. Yeah, that is interesting. Well, me and Matt went to the same high school.
We did.
We're only a year apart. I got to see a lot of Matt's, his less mature actions as a high schooler.
Nobody looked at us and said, that's what I want to be someday.
No, that's such a good example of a Mormon family. I don't think they did. You're right, Matt. We weren't bad kids. Well,
so Robert,
wasn't.
Was it a flirt to convert situation for you, Robert? You met them and
No, it wasn't, because I didn't meet my wife until I was our first meeting was 25, and we didn't get married until we were 30, but we didn't start dating either until I was 29.
Oh,
so yeah, I joined. My conversion to the church was definitely not affiliated with any persuasion of the female, gender. So
there were not sister missionaries at your door.
No. I was only taught by elders, but
Well, so, what was your life like growing up in Oregon?
Oregon was okay. Oregon was a lot of fun. As kids, you play a lot in the woods, and make forts, and you just have a great time. Right. And in the forests of Oregon. But yeah, most of my hardship as a youth probably comes from my experience in California, going to high school there and you know, we were not well off growing up. My dad was a preacher. He was also disabled in working construction, you know, and then later became a preacher. But I remember growing up, you know, in the basement of churches and eating beans and bread, you know, for days at a time.
Wow.
But as kids, you know, we never understood, right, that we were poor. I came from a split family. So my dad remarried and I actually have like six stepbrothers and sisters.
Wow.
So yeah, we never thought that we were, you know, what society thinks of as poor. You know, that those thoughts never really crossed our mind. So, but California was definitely a different experience to me. In my youth, like a lot of kids that I think that don't affiliate with the church or even in the church too, but I was caught up in a lot of, you know, youthful activities that took me into, you know, getting in trouble quite a bit, you know, as a teenager. So, yeah.
So then what brought you to our church? Your dad's a preacher. Was like scripture and stuff a big part of your life growing up?
No, my dad carried the philosophy of not trying to coerce or force, you know, his kids to go to church. If I had started the conversation with him, absolutely, he was privy to share his opinion and his experience in religion. But and I even remember, you know, when the elders gave me the Book of Mormon for the first time, and you know, starting to read it and asking my dad his opinions on it. And even as a preacher, my dad said he could not find anything incorrect about the book, and he believed it to be a true book.
Whoa!
Absolutely, yeah. Wow. But he never joined the church either. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
yeah. So that certainly, you know, he was. I think his approach to it was the same as mine, where, you know, I want to experience something or analyze something on the merits of what it is, not try to carry any unbiased, you know, approach to my consideration of the Book of Mormon. I think his philosophy was basically the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think we call it, you know, unconscious bias a lot of times, even in science.
Yeah.
When we do science experiments. So,
yeah.
So was reading the Book of Mormon, like, was it familiar to you, or was it kind of hard to understand, hard to get into? Like, what was your experience with just this new kind of scriptural stuff?
Well, it was all new to me.
Yeah.
At 19.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'd not read the Bible before in its entirety. The Book of Mormon was certainly new to me as well. But my attraction, I guess, to the church originally was the contrast that I had experienced outside of the church, right? All of the trials and the contention, maybe, or the dark side of life. And then being exposed to the Book of Mormon, you know, when I heard that members of the church don't drink, that just, you know, drank alcohol, that just blew my mind. I had no idea. But to me, in my mind, like, that was what was familiar. You talk about familiarity with things. I knew drinking was wrong, right? Mm-hmm. I knew smoking or drugs. I knew all of that was wrong. But to hear it from, you know, an institution that promotes people or encourages people to be good, that kind of solidified my understanding that, or, you know, reinforced my understanding that there's a good chance that it's a good thing to attach myself to, right?
Huh, so yeah. And what about like prayer or like developing a relationship with Heavenly Father? Was that new?
Yeah, so that's part of my conversion, really, because when I lived in California, I worked on a drilling rig. You know, I was a deckhand on a drilling rig.
Ooh.
And I remember going to these Christian, you know, religious groups and them teaching us about prayer. And so I had started praying even before I joined the church. And I felt like, you know, prayer to me was an opportunity to get to have an influence in my life for good. And I feel that it, you know, it prompted me to investigate different religions and ultimately, you know, find a place, you know, in this church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So
was that an easy transition for you, becoming a member of the church?
Great question. And I get this occasionally. You know, I think a lot of people think it's a hard transition, but just because, you know, for example, I mean, I was drinking a pot of coffee a day.
Wow.
At 19. Wow. And I was thinking, you know, this is the way the world works.
Yeah.
You know, but it was so simple to me and so easy when someone just suggested, why don't you drink a pot of water or a cup of water instead of a cup of coffee? That to me in my mind was pretty logical. But when I think of my conversion though, and all the things that I gave up, and when I think about the rewards of the church, you know, exaltation, the joy that comes from living the gospel, I think it was an easy thing to give up to me, right, in my mind. So,
yeah. So my perspective is I was born in the church. I've been a member of the church my whole life. And I see people come into the church and I see people leave the church. And then I just ask these questions to myself of like, what's going on there? And it seems like there are people when they join the church, they find out things they never knew about before, or something happens in the church that they hadn't expected. And then they're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, what did I do? And then they just sort of leave. What was it about you that like made you say, because you must have encountered similar kinds of things and said, yeah, but I'm not going to leave over that.
Yeah. So another good question, Matt. I'm really impressed.
Matt is so good at questions.
So yeah, there, you know, because I went to Institute all the time. I tried to go to Institute as much as I could. I researched church history. You know, I dove into the Mormon religion as much as I could and studied, you know, Joseph Smith. I'm certainly not an expert, but when it comes to like the hard questions that people have posed, you know, why did Joseph Smith have a six shooter, you know, or a pistol in Carthage jail, or, you know, what? Just, I mean, there's a ton of questions, right, that we get. And I've found that when I look at history and I consider what Joseph Smith did, I think, you know, there's the pundit or the critic, right, that has to write his opinion about what occurred in church history. But he wasn't there, right?
Yeah.
And all of the impressions that I get from Joseph Smith, that I get from, you know, other leaders of the church, is that they love their people, right? Look at Joseph Smith. You know, he died at what is he, 42 or 44? Mm-hmm. He lived half a life. And for what? To me, that is all a perspective from an individual who wanted to sacrifice everything for the betterment of the cause and his people. Yeah. So, I mean, people will call him a charlatan or whatever. And I, you know, we weren't there. We don't know the intentions of his heart just based on us not being there. So, I mean, yeah, there's a certain perspective, I think, in my mind, where you look at the critics or you look at things, blog posts or internet, whatever you find on the internet. And I think we really need to consider the very fact that we weren't there. We didn't experience the trials that the early saints experienced. And so our opinion is limited, right?
Yeah.
When it comes to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder, you know, now you're this, from an outside view, you know, you're just this dad in the church with this super LDS family. And I wonder how, because a lot of the way that we do things as parents is cultural as far as Mormonism. And I wonder how you are, you know, navigating now raising kids in the gospel with this cultural versus this whole like really religious experience that you've had, you know, the way that you look at things.
Yeah. So when I joined the church, I had some great examples. I can think of a few people. There was this family that I knew, the Blanchards, right? And I would go at 19 years old, I'd go to their house and I would see like how great their children were, you know, and how great they were at scripture study and how, you know, devoted they were to having scripture study every night. And I realize this now as a dad and a father, but the kids were just, you know, behaving because there was a guest in the house, clearly. But so when I look at my family, I kind of tease my wife and I say, because, you know, she grew up in a family of 11. And I ask her, I say, you know, because my kid, you know, all kids probably.
Yeah. All of them.
And I ask her, I tease her and I say, is this how it works? You know, do your brothers and sisters, you know, not pay attention or, you know, anyway, it's caused us to be kind of creative when it comes to scripture study or, you know, prayer. But yeah, for sure. When it comes to, you know, cause I didn't grow up like that. Right.
Yeah.
I didn't have those experiences, but it's certainly for a convert, there's a learning curve, right? In those respects. But yeah, we kind of figure it out. I think like most families, you know, figure it out. So, yeah.
So a while ago, I was home teacher to a family and they had had a home teacher prior to me. It was Elder Bednar was their home teacher. He wasn't a member of the Quorum of the 12 yet, but it was funny because like, so their daughter, by the time I was their home teacher, she was like a young adult. But they would tell me stories about when Elder Bednar, who wasn't elder, but when he would come home teaching, how this girl would run away and hide because she was so afraid of Elder Bednar, the home teacher, because like it would just become, I don't know, just maybe a different kind of atmosphere, right, than what she was used to. And I thought, yeah, it's like kids are just like that, right? Doesn't matter who your home teacher is or who your parents are or what they're trying to teach you. Kids often don't love a formal setting to sit down and talk about church.
Yeah.
At home.
But I do think something that will be great for your kids is that it seems like, you know, if they have questions, great. Let's have questions. Let's have dialogue. Let's talk. Like, I think that that's something that converts are able to bring is just this more open view to exploring the gospel without, you know, without having like fear of what could come.
Good point. Yeah. And I try to talk to my kids as much as I can. I try to keep that open line of communication and trust there. I tell my kids a lot too that, and in my perspective as convert, this is how I view a lot of the world is that I refer to it as the universal law, which is you make good choices, good things happen, and call it karma. You could call it, you know, a lot of things, but I think the gospel in its entirety, as it teaches us to find more joy in life, it also, and you know, relates to the universal law, right? Make good choices, good things happen. Bad choices, bad things happen. So, for sure, agreed.
So I have some questions about other topics, like why do you want to be a U.S. senator and why do you want to be independent? Why are you has anybody told you?
What are you doing with your life, Rob?
Has anyone told you the statistical probability of winning as an independent? Like maybe Evan McMullen. Did you ever chat with Evan McMullen and say, how'd that go for you?
Yeah. I know what you're saying and I hear where you're coming from. To me, in my opinion, you know, and the reason why I joined the U.S. Senate race has a lot to do with my perspective on the erosion of the Constitution. You know, as when I joined the military and my experience in the Department of Defense for the last 15 years was or has been this understanding that I made a commitment right when I joined the U.S. military, put my arm to the square and swore to defend, support, and defend the Constitution against all foreign, against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And so as someone who served in the military, that oath does not go away in this lifetime. It's absolutely 100%. It stays with us. And so to me, when I think of someone who serves their country, you know, we call politicians, a lot of times we call it, you know, service to their country, but
right.
I've seen the kinds of service that I've seen on active duty and with the Department of Defense has been a kind of service that is selfless, right? I mean, these men and women volunteer their time. They volunteer themselves to be in harm's way for our freedoms. So that this stuff speaks to me on a level that I think has motivated me to join the race and remind people, especially the perspective that I've seen here recently. I'll give you one example, yeah. And I'll try to be nonpartisan here, but.
Well, you can be an independent partisan, right? Because that's your party.
Okay. So when we consider Department of Homeland Security and all the changes that have come in post-Patriot Act, you know, 2003, 2004, we see all the changes that have come in since 2016 and even more recently from 2020, and specifically the Department of Homeland Defense, Department of Homeland Security has published documents that criminalize and penalize mal, mis, and disinformation,
mm-hmm.
Primarily through the internet, but that speaks to the root of our First Amendment right.
Mm-hmm.
And when you criminalize it and specifically link it to domestic terrorism, then I have to stand up, right, and say, you know, wait a minute. This is our First Amendment.
Yeah.
Right to free speech. I disagree with it.
Uh-huh.
You know, passively, of course.
You disagree with this speech. I passively disagree with it. Yeah.
This is documentation that they've published on their website.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, okay, what she's saying is she's just clarifying. Yeah. Even if you disagree with what they're saying, you still support their right to say it.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And so I get, you know, because I've worked in the Department of Defense, I've worked cyber warfare for a lot of years. And I get the concern with disinformation or malinformation. But we have to either change the Constitution or we have to find ways to fix it. To me, when I think of mal, mis, and disinformation, I think of, you know, what's the greatest nemesis to mal, mis, and disinformation? It's trusted sources. You're right. Yeah, exactly, Matt. So, you know, find a trusted source.
Yeah.
Make sure that they have data that reinforces their opinion about certain political topics. Or, you know, the DHS and this mal, mis, and disinformation, they've criminalized or penalized anyone speaking out against health, environmental, or politics specifically. Mm-hmm. So if anyone speaks out against COVID, they're in jeopardy of you know, being penalized somehow through the FCC or even the FBI if they consider it a domestic, tied to domestic terrorism. So, yeah, all those things, you know, motivated me to join the race, you know, get this information out and ensure that people understand that this erosion will just get worse. Right. If we go on this current trajectory.
So if you were the senator from Utah, what would you do about that? Is there a law that you would change? Is there some kind of congressional oversight of Department of Homeland Security? Like, how would you go about changing that as a senator?
Which aspect? Changing
the Department of Homeland Security's rule that they have that misinformation or malinformation could be considered domestic terrorism.
Yeah. So to me, I think Secretary Mayorkas needs to be impeached, not just for his border debacle, but also for his endorsing this mal, mis, and disinformation. To me, I believe the Patriot Act needs to be either radically amended or repealed.
Mm.
You know, we're out of Afghanistan. We're out of, you know, Iraq. The war on terrorism still... it's still active, but I, at the very least, to me, in my opinion, I think it should be radically amended.
I do. There is something interesting that, like, if you go to the 1800s, so many of the elected officials had some kind of military background, some kind of military experience. And since World War II, we've really seen an erosion of that in American society, that fewer and fewer elected officials have experience in the military. I wonder, from your perspective, would it be better if there were more people with military background in elected office, or is it a good change the way things have changed?
Yes, I agree, Matt. I was reading some statistics here today, and the other day about World War II and how many of our youth and adults were drafted in World War II. Something like 12 million in the United States were draftees. We are no doubt on the precipice of another world war. They just advanced the doomsday clock, you know, another 30 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. There's all these, to me, you know, as I, in my experience in the Department of Defense, I analyzed vulnerabilities, susceptibilities from China and Russia. I dove really deep into these issues. And I see a cascading effect, primarily associated with my understanding of foreign policy as it relates to how we deal with Russia, how we deal with the Middle East and China. But I definitely see a cascading effect. But to your question, I believe that, these issues we have to be aware of, going in to this election year. A lot of people, need to step up, put away complacency, and be involved in their electoral process. And this is just, you know, we are being bombarded with all kinds of threats and susceptibilities, whether it's our constitution, whether it's foreign adversaries, or even the intrusion of, you know, topics like ESG and DEI in our school system. To me, you know, if you trace back where, and I won't get into the details too much about this unless you want to, but if you trace back the origins of DEI and ESG, it comes from the United Nations. So you have an entity that we've spent billions of dollars supporting, and behind the guise of good intentions, because they do a lot of good work, the United Nations does, but sure, behind the guise of good intentions, they've implemented this DEI ESG strategy, which is just another affirmative action. It's just rebranded, right? Yeah. We're absolutely, to me, a senator needs to be aware of this stuff, cannot be influenced by big donors, and cannot be influenced by lobbyists or, you know, special interest groups. And I take the time, and the people that I associate with on my team take the time to do the right research, get the right data from trusted sources, and then we make an opinion based on, you know, those kinds of influences. So
Melissa, do you feel like, it's interesting, this perspective, because I think that a lot of people would listen to you and be like, regardless of which party they're in, like, yeah, I can understand that, or I can agree with that, or I've thought that too. Do you think that really is kind of the overarching problem, is that we've really just got two parties, and if you're financially backed, then good for you, and if not, then good luck. But we're not really, this is just maybe my opinion, but it doesn't seem like we're able to accomplish a whole lot other than getting the word out, I guess, if you're not beholden to big financiers.
Yeah. You know, I've read reports about politicians going to Washington and them trying to stand up for what they believe or their conscience and how to vote, you know, based on their conscience, and their own political party threatening them with no reelection.
Yeah.
To persuade them to vote the way their party is voting. Mm-hmm. I just fundamentally disagree with that. In fact, I am a proponent of term limits for congressmen. I have no intention of running more than one term. So
wow. I hope you can fix the problem in 6 years.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of fixing the problem, Matt. I think it's just a matter of getting different people in Congress instead of your 30 or 40 year tenured, you know, congressman. I'll tell you the truth, Matt. I didn't join the race to, you know, because I have, you know, this lifelong dream to be a senator. Mm-hmm. I joined the race because I saw real threats, threatening my way of life, threatening my community's way of life. So I, in fact, as an engineer, I'm a systems engineer. I still work with Department of Defense weapon systems. It's not really a huge pay raise for me. So, I mean, it isn't.
Yeah. You're not doing it for the money or the prestige.
And I'm not doing it to move to Washington, D.C., right? Because I never liked the East Coast. It's really crowded for me, but I've been there quite a bit, but yeah.
Well, I wonder your perspective on this. I was having a conversation with someone the other day who, in fact, it was just yesterday, and he was like, look, I read the news and I'm afraid, and but he's on the other side, right? He says, if Trump gets reelected, I worry for my country and for my freedom. And I know that there's people on that feel that way about Joe Biden. It feels like a lot of people feel like there are existential threats in politics, but it's people on both sides of the aisle looking and saying like, wow, like these are real problems. I wonder how you fix that. How would you fix that?
Yeah, there is a great degree of polarization in our politics, more than I've remember reading about in history or in my lifetime. There's a great deal of polarization. But, you know, I listened to the State of the Union speech last night, and I listened to Donald Trump, and I just hear everything that's being said on both sides, in all political parties. Well, the two political parties, right? just rancor and, you know, more division, more polarization. An independent candidate can help bridge those gaps. And to me, in my campaign, what I'm focusing on is reminding people, I don't want to go back, right? As Biden says, go back and make America great again necessarily. But it's building relationships of trust by reminding people that our Constitution is our standard of liberty, right? Mm-hmm. To quote Moroni, Captain mm-hmm. Moroni. To me, it's reminding people of our Bill of Rights and the rights of the people and preserving those rights. And then those bridges, I think, can be rebuilt among both Republican and Democrat. I mean, I anticipate in caucusing with the Republicans for sure. But to me, that's how we build relationships mm-hmm. again on common beliefs.
He's speaking your language, right, Melissa? You love that stuff.
Well, I do feel like all parties talk about like the Constitution, like this is what our foundation is. But I don't ever really see the connections of the policies that we're making and how those are supporting the Constitution. To me, that's what the big disconnect is. Mm. And I do like the idea that, like, yeah, we really do. We need to find ways to connect with each other again, to build bridges, to focus on our common beliefs. And that should be Constitution, at least, you know, in the United States.
So is there something about the church or the teachings of the church that helps here, that maybe brings you guys comfort or helps you to not worry so much? Or does the church do anything to help here?
Melissa, do you want to take first stab at that?
You know, I will take first stab at it. I actually am not fearful. I think what the church brings me is a belief that people are good. And so when I live my life and walk through my life, you don't have to be a member of the church for me to believe this, but I really believe that foundationally we're all children of God and that we are all good. We all are trying our best. We're doing what we know how to do. And maybe, you know, what I know how to do is different than what you know how to do, but it doesn't mean that you're not still good and not still trying. So for me, I don't have like the despair. I just like to believe the best in people. And then I think for me, that's just how I feel good about moving through life in the world. And then just, you know, everything's going to be fine is kind of how I look at it. But I'm not a politician. I'm not, you know, trying to get my voice heard, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me give you an example, maybe that'll help bring clarity to my perspective. When we consider, because I, in the military, as an engineer, I help implement advanced technologies, specifically in autonomous behavior or autonomous technology. And so I'm pretty familiar with AI. And so when we consider AI and all the dangers that come, that may come with it, we have a continual evolution of AI from its conception to the different forms of it. What I worked on was what's called computer vision. So anything video, you take data points from videos and you apply it to your autonomous behavior. But if you look at the other segments of what AI is, whether it's large language models or generative AI, or what they eventually anticipate obtaining, which is AGI, artificial general intelligence. To me, I think, to answer your question, Matt, to me, I think this gift has been given to us, right, for whatever reason, but it's up to us to determine how this evolves into AGI. Mm. To me, I think the government, without correct oversight, congressional oversight of tech industry, some very dangerous things can occur.
Yeah.
We look at Tesla or Elon Musk and how he's, Optimus, the robot?
I forgot
the name of it, but, those are advancing almost as quickly as AI is. And so when you couple AI and, these incredibly performance-driven robots, there's some dangerous scenarios, right, that can come about. And especially when you give government the latitude to do a lot of overreach and even tyranny, right, or oppression. And even in our government, when it gets too big, those are all vulnerabilities or threats that we should, as the people, should be aware of. So, to answer your question, I think I'm not afraid of what's coming, but I certainly think that we can influence, right, the product, the end product. Mm-hmm. And that very much is paralleled with how involved we get in politics. Right.
And if we don't get involved, we're allowing other people to make those decisions for us.
Absolutely. And here's a good example. Look at Captain Moroni, right? They were faithful saints. Look at Joseph Smith and how he was involved in the presidency of the United States. All these elements, to me, when I think of the scriptures or what's in the Book of Mormon, there's figures that have arisen in these stories that we learn that tried to influence people or remind people that they have a role in their liberty. So, yeah. Captain Moroni did the same thing. But
I have a very specific question that's only going to matter to our listeners in Idaho, but there's something happened. I want your expertise on this question. So the Idaho State Senate, it hasn't become law yet. They passed a bill that would make it so that the state of Idaho's National Guard cannot be sent into active duty, active service, unless Congress first declares a war, which hasn't happened since World War II, right? So there's this feeling that like the National Guard is getting used as active duty forces in the place of our active duty forces. And I think they kind of want to push back on that. The argument I heard against that was that it would hurt the Idaho National Guard in some way because the Pentagon would say, you're not going to be combat ready or we can't use you or so. Anyhow, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think I know why they passed that law, and that's in response to what Governor Abbott did in Texas as far as pushing back on the federal government. Because the federal government wanted to activate Texas National Guard, and Governor Abbott, because they were at the border, and they put up the razor wire. I think it's in response to that, but I think in the long term, they're protecting themselves against the federal government from coming in and activating the National Guard without a state provision in place to prevent that.
Okay.
So
that makes sense. Yeah, that's something I don't know very much about. I don't know much about.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, do I agree with it? I absolutely. I think state rights, this is a constitutional republic. You know, state has absolutely the right to do that. You know, there's the Wars Act.
War Powers Resolution.
There you go. That prevents the president from committing troops beyond like 30 or 60, 90 days without congressional act of war. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. That's good. And I think, you know, in the coming years, I would like to push that Utah, Idaho, you know, these interior states that are feeling this progressive movement, and really it's a progressive oppression. I think that the interior states would very much benefit from a compact or some kind of a multi-state agreement to work together more. So
Melissa hates it when I get deep into policy. So
I don't hate it. It's just that when you do, I look dumb and it's fine.
Yeah. Do you have other questions you want to ask Melissa?
About politics?
No. No, yeah. You usually like to go more in the...
I do. Yeah. Here's a question.
Okay.
Tell me about how you're managing to run this campaign and still be a dad. And also, is your wife drowning, trying to take on all of this while you take on all of that?
Yeah. So I try to maximize my campaigning to podcasts, you know, telephone calls, and things I can do on specifically Fridays and Saturdays. I'm not a politician who can break away, because I have a full-time, you know, I work during the day. Yeah. I can't break away and travel the state, you know, up and down the state like some of these well-funded politicians.
Right.
I definitely married up, right? She, you know, she served her mission in Thailand. You know, that was oddly enough, I didn't serve a mission. I served in the military, but oddly enough, that was like, to me, on my list of people to marry, that was like one of the cool things I wanted to have, was a wife that, served a mission. But she is by, you know, for sure, supportive, and she is, we do a lot of things together because she works full time and I work full time, but, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, the key there, Melissa, I think is a lot of communication when it comes to that stuff. But, I don't have a full time job campaigning. So
yeah. Yeah.
You're all busy. So Robert, does she bring Thai culture into your home? Thai food into your...
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Sticky rice and mangoes.
Oh yeah. Yeah. She likes, the sticky rice and, oh, the dessert. You're talking about the dessert, the mango and sticky rice dessert. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It, in fact, we just had it last night for dinner, but she went to, Young Women's, and she was able to share, you know, had all these, she fed them dinner and had all these, you know, props up, but she likes to do that stuff. She likes to talk about her mission and how great it was. In fact, she went back to the Thailand temple dedication. So yeah, she was that, she's that involved.
That's so cool.
Well, what's cool, and this is what's neat from, you know, you talk about genealogy, but I'm related to William Bradford, you know, the first Thanksgiving guy.
Mm-hmm.
My mom is a Washington. So I'm related to George Washington. Yeah. But my wife, she's related to Mary Elizabeth Rollins, if that sounds familiar to you.
The Doctrine and Covenants, in Far West.
That's right. Yeah. And she's related to James Henry Rollins, who was a bodyguard for Joseph Smith. So we kind of have interesting, you know, interesting genealogy, but it, she's for sure married up, and I appreciate her saying yes, you know, when I pose the question. So,
well, that's great. So Robert, if our listeners want to get in touch with you or want to follow you or want to find you, how would they find you?
So we have a website. It's senatornewcomb.com. I am active on Twitter. I will be active on YouTube. I have another podcast to do here in a week or so. So those will be posted on YouTube. But my Gmail is senatornewcomb@gmail.com.
Right.
But those are for sure avenues to get a hold of me.
Okay. And if you're like me, okay, and you come across as dumb when it comes to all of the stuff we've been talking about, what would you say to someone like me? Like, what is something that your everyday average member of the church, what's the first thing you would tell them to do to just, you know, make a change in the world or to move forward kind of the discussions that we've been having?
So I would echo the encouragement and admonition of the church when it comes to consider your candidates. Consider each electable candidate on their integrity and their willingness to serve their interests. But to be involved, you know, in politics you don't have to have a huge background. To me, it's a lot of intuition, maybe a little praying and looking for the candidate that it fits those kinds of descriptions. So,
yeah, this is what Matt says a lot, right? Like, go ahead and say it, Matt. You know what I'm thinking. You're thinking.
Yeah. Well, so getting involved is not just running for office. And just like we were talking about on the big picture, that if we don't do something, we cede that influence to other people. That applies all the way down to our local level. There's library boards, there's school boards, there's county boards. All of these people, all of these places need people to fill those roles. And if we're not filling those roles, we're going to allow other people with different values to fill those roles. Yeah. Do you agree with that, Melissa? Is that what I was going to say?
I agree with that. No, yeah. I thought you were going to say that what's most important is that you vote for a good person.
Oh, 100%. Yes. Yeah. In voting. Yeah. In the Doctrine and Covenants, that's what it says, right? When the wicked rule, people mourn. So you've got to look for righteous people. Yeah. Well, Robert, great. Thank you so much for joining us. It was great Absolutely. To get to know you.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks so much to our listeners. And we will see you again on the next time we see you.
That's so specific, Melissa.